Answer questions 1 to 5 while you listen. Use not more than 5 words for each answer. You will hear the recording twice. You now have 25 seconds to read the questions.
Passage 1. Good morning, students. I hope you have been able to visit the Museum of Social History to see the exhibition presented by the food industry that is currently showing. Today's lecture deals with the history of chocolate. Our knowledge of the history of chocolate is rather vague, but we are aware that the Mayans and Aztecs of South America made a drink from the beans of the cocoa tree and called it Xocoatl. Then in 1582, this was taken home by the Spanish, who named it chocolate. This was the first experience Europeans had of chocolate, but by the late 1600s, it had spread to most countries of the world. In the 18th and 19th centuries, drinking chocolate became a well-established activity, but it was not until 1847 that Fry and Sons in England introduced eating chocolate. This remained much of a novelty until Daniel Peter, the famed Swiss chocolate maker, was inspired to improve the smoothness and taste of the new confection. Peter's idea is to combine some other ingredients with chocolate to balance its rough flavor. His early experiments with cheese were notoriously unsuccessful, and a number of other ill-fated mixtures followed. Finally, in 1874, stumbled on the perfect answer, milk. Nowadays, milk chocolate is made of at least 10% chocolate mass, raw chocolate pressed from cocoa nibs, and 12% milk solids combined with sugar, cocoa butter, the fat from the nibs, and vanilla. It is also the type of chocolate often chosen by children because it is less bitter than the dark varieties.
Passage 2. Weather in Britain seems to be a favourite conversation topic. The reason why people talk about the weather is that it is very unpredictable. In Britain, you can never tell what the weather will be the next day. In spring, it may shower one day, but wind the next, and then be cloudy the next. In summer, the temperature rises. They usually go up to 20 degrees or 25 degrees, but people start complaining if it gets over 30 degrees. The weather is changeable, hot and sunny one day, cool and misty the next. In fact, for many years it seems to rain all summer, especially in August, but for some other years, like 1976, there was a very hot summer and a drought. There was no rain for 3 months, which was very unusual. The autumn may be golden or damp and misty. London used to be famous for foggy Novembers, but seldom can you get thicker fogs these years. In winter, it is usually pretty chilly, with temperatures between 0 degrees to 10 degrees. It snows some years and not others. For example, the weather of 1981 to 1982 was very cold. There was snow all over the country for 4 months, and the temperature dropped to minus 17 in many places. But the winter of 1982 to 1983 was a mild one with hardly any snow. You maybe listen to the weather forecast on the radio or on TV in the morning, but often people find that the weather changes faster than the reporter can predict. So people do not rely as much on the forecast as they do on umbrellas.
Passage 3. In Kansas City, a computer helps firemen. The computer contains information about every one of the 350,000 street addresses in the city. When firemen answer a call, the computer gives them information about the burning buildings. The computer can give the location of the building, its size, type, and contents. In fact, the computer has many different ways of helping firefighters with their problems. For example, it can give medical information about the sick people living in a burning building. With this information, the firemen can take special care to find these sick persons and to remove them quickly and safely from the burning building. The speed of the computer is amazing. Within 2 or 3 seconds after a call is received, the computer provides necessary information for the firemen. The information is then sent to them by radio from the computer center in the city hall. The Kansas City computer system also contains a medical record of each of the city's 900 firemen. This kind of information is especially useful when a firefighter is injured. With this medical information, doctors at the hospital can treat the injured firemen more quickly and easily. Kansas City firemen themselves are thankful for the computer's help. The computer tells them about possible dangers ahead of them and helps them prepare for them. Many times the computer helps to save lives and property. Sometimes the lives of those of firemen themselves.
Passage 4. Alaska, which was called Russian America before it was sold to the United States of America, joined the Union as the 49th state in 1959. Alaska is now the largest of all the 50 states of the United States. It was in 1867 that President A. Johnson, Secretary of State, Seward, bought Alaska from the Russians at a cost of $7.2 million. The buying of the huge northern landmass seemed at first something foolishly done. Not only was Alaska difficult to reach, but it was also hard to live in, and it appeared to have no importance in the time of war. Besides, there are volcanoes, as Alaska lies on the Pacific Ring of Fire. In Alaska, large treeless areas are covered with snow all the year. For these reasons, the buying of Alaska was called Seward's folly at the time. However, in 1896, gold was found in Alaska, and people poured into the land quickly. Since then, other important resources were discovered, including oil. Soon, people changed their thinking about Seward's folly. But most people visit Alaska in order to see the endless beauty of nature that the northern land discloses to them. For instance, there are about 11,000 islands in Alaska. And in a certain area of Alaska, the sun does not set for 82 days each year.
Passage 5. Good morning, and welcome to American Studies 101. I would like to begin this semester by discussing the region of the United States known as the Northeast. This region included 12 states and a small area called the District of Columbia. That is the home of the national government. The Northeast is a very important part of the United States. Although it covers only about 6% of the nation's geographic area, it contains approximately 1/4 of the country's population. New York, the most populous city in the United States, and several other large cities are located in this region. Why are these 12 states so important? In the first place, the Northeast was one of the first sections of the country to be settled by Europeans. 6 busy cities developed there, while most of America was a still sparsely settled wilderness. Many crucial events in the nation's early history took place there. I will be describing some of the events Wednesday, in my second lecture. Today, the Northeast is a great manufacturing and trading region. Thousands of factories produce a wide variety of goods and provide other regions of the country with items they need. Many large manufacturing firms have their central headquarters here. Some of the country's largest banks, investment agencies, and publishing houses can be found in the Northeast. Several of its cities are noted for fine museums. Some of the country's best-known colleges and universities are also located in this region. Finally, the Northeast is the principal location of much of the country's international trade. In the heart of this region, in New York City, is the home of the United Nations.
Passage 6. The United States is a country made up of many different races. Usually they are mixed together and cannot be told from one another. But many of them still talk about where their ancestors came from. It is something they are proud of. The original Americans, of course, were Indians. The so-called white men were mostly from England. But many came from other countries like Germany and France. One problem the United States always had is racial discrimination. As new groups came to the United States, they found they were discriminated. First, it was the Irish and Italians. Later, it was the blacks. Almost every group has been able to eventually escape the discrimination. The only who are not are the blacks. Surprisingly enough, discrimination is shown towards the Indians. One reason the Indians are discriminated against is that they have tried so hard to keep their identity. Of course, they were the only ones who have done so. The Japanese have their little Tokyo in Los Angeles, and the Chinese the Chinatown in New York. The Dutch settlement in Pennsylvania also stays separated from other people. Their towns are like something from the 19th century. They have a different reason than the other groups for staying apart. They live separately for religious reasons, rather than keeping together in a racial group. Many people still come from other countries to help the United States grow. A good example is the American project that let a man walk on the moon. It was a scientist from Germany who was most responsible for doing that. It is certain that in the future the United States will still need the help of people from all racial groups to remain a great country.
Passage 7. Mark Twain was the pen name of Samuel Langhorne Clemens, a remarkable American born near Hannibal, Missouri, in 1835. Apprenticed to a printer, he soon left to be an apprentice river pilot, then a licensed pilot on Mississippi River steamboats. Life on the Mississippi might have remained Clemens's occupation, but the Civil War disrupted river traffic, and later the railroads ceded the boats. Clemens became a newspaper correspondent, and after his writing achieved national attention, a novelist. The Adventures of Tom Sawyer and the stories of Huckleberry Finn, Becky Thatcher and others brought him acclaim for his development of a uniquely American literature. Mark Twain later achieved distinction as a lecturer who employed his wry humor to the delight of audiences. There were other sides of Clemens' life. In business, he was a failure, and his despair for human conduct surfaced in his later Little Red works. Fortunately, he has remembered adventures of some very human children and the misadventures of a celebrated jumping frog of Calaveras County.
Passage 8. Many university students dislike studying history because there is little to get excited about when historical events are presented in a boring manner. However, I will never forget my American history professor, Dr. Williams. Each event leaped from the pages of our text and became as real as the daily reports on the radio. My favorite lecture concerned the American Revolution. Dr. Williams set the mood for the story by imitating Paul Revere, a well-known silversmith working in his shop. The American colonists were angry because of the British control over their lives. Revere felt the war between the British and the colonists was imminent. Then Dr. Williams told us about Revere rowing across the Charles River from Boston on April the 18th, 1775. I can see the professor now as he raised his hand to his forehead, as he were looking across the Charles River to the Old North Church in Boston. Suddenly, spotted two lanterns, a signal which meant that the British would attack by sea. He jumped on his horse to warn the villagers of the attack. Professor Williams reminded us that the first battles of American revolutions were fought at Concord and at Lexington, Massachusetts, the year before the Declaration of Independence was signed in 1776. Never before had history seemed so alive to me, and all because the professor cared enough to put his heart into his teaching.
Passage 9. America enjoyed a great economic boom during the 1920s. This was fueled by rapid highway construction, automobile manufacturing, and the new electrical appliances coming on the market, such as radios, refrigerators, vacuum cleaners, and the like. Not everyone enjoyed the prosperity. There was technical unemployment, and the farmers suffered from overproduction and excessive debt. Nevertheless, the stock market climbed to a dizzy height, for investors believed that there would be no tomorrow. A great crash of the stock market occurred in 1929. This was only one element in a national and international economic depression of massive proportions. Exports fell, manufacturing declined, agricultural surpluses mounted, and unemployment spiraled upward. The depression alarmed the national government, but President Herbert Hoover opposed subsidizing the unemployed. Change came with the election in 1932 of President D. Roosevelt and his program called the New Deal. There was an immediate government intervention into the economy to aid business and put men to work. American reactionaries felt that Mr. Roosevelt was instituting communism. His friends replied that he was rejuvenating capitalism. Prosperity didn't return to America until the nation began to rearm for the coming war. Thus, the New Deal didn't end the depression, but it ameliorated the hardships for many, and it ended the national government attitude that it could not concern itself with the well-being of the common man.
Passage 10. Welcome, everyone, to this workshop on student housing. I'll go through the information about types of housing available for the fall and the procedure for application. Then, if you have any questions, feel free to ask me. There are three main types of housing here for you to choose from: the student dorms, the married student apartments, and the international houses. As for now, there is some space available in each type, but they are filling up fast. You should get your application in as soon as possible. Let me explain some of the main features of type of housing. The student dorms are for any student. We have men's dorms, women's dorms, and co-dorms. There is one large bathroom and shower area for both sexes to use. Most of the rooms have 2 beds, 2 closets, and 2 desks. We also have a few triples and a few single suites, but I think the suites are already taken. There are no cooking facilities in the dorms, but you can buy a meal ticket for the cafeteria. The married student apartments are for married students only. Each apartment has a kitchen, a living dining area, and either 1 or 2 bedrooms. Children are allowed in the apartments.
The international houses are a group of apartments for both foreigner students and resident students. They are organized into language and culture during mean times. It's been a good way for students to learn about other cultures and languages. I think that Spanish house is full, but there are rooms available in all the other